Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. And we have a real treat today, and because we've already done this recording, the interview, we know how much of a treat it is. It's an interview with my colleague, Dr. Christine de Blasio, and the topic is going to be about trauma and empowerment. So, before we get to the interview, I just want to say a little bit about this podcast for people for whom it might be new. This podcast is based on my book, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And the book, in turn, is based on the 7-word formula that is couples therapy in 7 words. And the 7 words are...
Be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And in a lot of our episodes, we've been going through the chapters in the book, but when we have a special interview, we are just going to focus on the interview. So in a moment, we'll turn to the interview. We'd just like, before we do that, to invite you to comment and rate us on iTunes and like and share our posts on social media. That's how folks will continue to find out about our podcast. We've been getting great response from people, and we'd like to spread the word. So without further ado, let's turn to our interview with Dr. Christine de Blasio.
Our guest today is Dr. Christine de Blasio. Dr. de Blasio has been a clinical psychologist for over 30 years, working with a wide range of clinical issues. In July of 2014, Dr. de Blasio earned the rank of 4th-degree black belt in Kempo Jiu-Jitsu Karate. For over 15 years, she has offered workshops on empowerment self-defense and violence prevention at colleges, middle and high schools, and at both community and corporate settings. These trainings blend her background in psychology and martial arts to provide simple yet effective mental and physical self-defense strategies for women. She is a strong believer in empowering individuals through knowledge and skills. Together with a 7-member team of women with diverse professional backgrounds, Dr. de Blasio founded a nonprofit organization called The Safety Team, which is dedicated to the well-being, empowerment, resiliency, healing, and safety of women. Christine, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Oh, thank you, Judy. It's great to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. And Bruce, I know that you work with Christine or have worked with Christine.
And still do.
And still work with
indeed,
Christine.
Yes. Full disclosure, folks. Yes, indeed. Christine is one of my colleagues and is the director at Stonehouse Associates, which is a wonderful group of folks that I've been working with now for quite a while. And so that, of course, is how I got to know her and got to learn about the work that she does and thought she'd be a great guest for us to have on the podcast.
So, Christine, I just gave you that introduction. Why don't you tell us about the safety team?
Oh, the safety team, I could speak at length about the safety team because I'm so passionate about the mission that we all share. And when I say we are a 7-member team, all women, who are professionals in a diverse in all different fields, I guess I should say. We have a physical therapist, we have an educator, we have a police officer, we have a forensic toxicologist, we have a community outreach person, we have myself as a psychologist. All the members of the team have some exposure to violence against women, some expertise in that field, and collectively we bring that together to offer these empowerment workshops and now, in addition to the empowerment workshops, we're also offering what we call our therapeutic empowerment self-defense program, which is a specific program designed for survivors of sexual assault and other interpersonal violence. So the team's been around for about 15 years. We have offered workshops all over Vermont, and we continue to do so, COVID permitting. And it's been incredibly gratifying work for me.
So just following up on that, one of the things we wanted to ask you about, of course, our focus in our podcast here is especially couple relationships. Clearly, when people have experienced various forms of sexual violence or violence in general, that can actually affect their couple relationships. I'm curious what you have encountered and how some of your work is involved in helping people of course, heal individually, but also in terms of their relationships?
Well, you know, the impact of sexual assault and other violence, we know is can be profound. We know it can affect self-esteem. We know it can affect intimacy. We know it can affect communication. It can affect confidence levels. It's a pretty significant event or events that have longstanding impact on many survivors. And so given that, you would expect that there would be ripple effects then in all other relationships. So whether it be with your significant other, or even in terms of your parenting, it can have an impact. So when we do these workshops and we help with some of the healing, and we know in just even our community workshops, we know that a modest estimate would be between a third to perhaps even 60% of the women who are in these workshops are survivors, and these are just general community workshops. We know if we're helping to promote healing, then perhaps we are also helping in terms of what that might look like in their interpersonal relationships afterwards. You know, so if they're feeling more empowered, if they're healing, if their self-esteem has improved, if their body integrity has improved, this all can have a positive effect, or at least an effect, depending on the other partner, an effect on their interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, it's interesting you describe that. The effect, it isn't always positive with respect to a particular relationship, because I'm imagining, well, I know in many of the women I've worked with over the years, sometimes what happens is they come to realize that they're being treated in ways in their relationship that they just are now feel strong enough to realize that they don't have to accept. And so that can end up sometimes ending some relationships.
That may be. And I would say our goals with the safety team are kind of threefold. One is for women to feel like that they have a right to be safe, that they have more power in their bodies and their voice and their spirit than they may have realized, and that there's always something that they can do. There's actions that they can take to help reduce their risk. You know, so those are some of the things that we work on. And if you're in a relationship where those are not things that are valued by the other person, I could see how that could create some opportunity for discussion, let's say.
Yeah, one of the things I talk about a lot in this podcast and have written about in my book also is the idea of intimacy requiring that you tolerate anxiety for intimacy. And one of the ways you need to tolerate anxiety is the willingness to say things to your partner that your partner may not want to hear. And certainly that can come up when someone in a relationship is sort of newly empowered. They may be willing to say some things they had not been willing to say. And that can certainly rock the boat. And of course, if both parties can handle it, it can result in a much better relationship.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, in this way, if a person is feeling more empowered, and I'll use woman because that's primarily who we work with, anyone female identified in the empowerment self-defense classes or the therapeutic empowerment self-defense program that we offer. If a woman is feeling more comfortable sharing how she really feels, that can actually be incredibly positive aspect for the relationship because now there's less guesswork. Now there's, you know what's going on. Or if she's more comfortable sharing her history of trauma, that can really help a relationship in increasing understanding of what might account for certain behaviors or certain feelings, or, you know, that can take some of the mystery out of that, which can help both partners, I think.
And
I would add to that also, if the partner knows more about the trauma and what might activate the trauma traumatic response, then it allows them to work together and create a sense of safety and healing together, which could be incredibly positive for both parties.
Yeah, it really does. It helps a relationship grow. I've often commented on that with folks in couples work, that when you encounter a problem and that raises everybody's anxiety and work through it successfully, it builds confidence in the relationship. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, wow, we can handle this together. And that can be very, very positive indeed. Mm-hmm.
So, Christine, how does self-defense training help the women you work with, both individually and in their couple relationships?
So, the self-defense, I always preface it with empowerment self-defense. And I just want to sort of put out why. It isn't just about the physical aspects so much in terms of learning how to defend yourself. It's really about empowering yourself. We spend a lot of time both in our therapeutic empowerment self-defense program, which is specific to survivors, victims, and in our more general empowerment self-defense program. There's a component of empowerment self-defense program that is very much focused on Not increasing fear, but increasing awareness, increasing a sense of presence in your body, increasing confidence in your intuition and trusting yourself, increasing your belief in your right to use your voice. These are all things that don't require necessarily a whole lot of physical self-defense skills, but they're phenomenally important in improving self-confidence and how you might carry yourself and what you might choose to do in terms of your boundary setting and communicating, because there are self-defense programs that do not have necessarily the empowerment portion of it, and they're vastly different than the kind of program that we offer.
I think I'm thinking more of the other typical programs that I've seen other than what you're describing with the empowerment. So I wanted to know how that training that you give the women, how does it affect them individually and also in their couple relationships?
So what we hear from participants and what has been borne out, and there's a lot of research on empowerment self-defense, what we have seen and witnessed and been honored to be able to be a part of is seeing women feel more confident in who they are and how they carry themselves. It can be a profound difference in terms of, this can happen in a 2.5-hour workshop, a profound difference between how they walk into the workshop and how they walk out of the workshop. You can see it in terms of how they just simply carry their bodies. You know, there's more of an integration of the mind and body as they go through some of these programs. We have series where we do 3 sessions. People can come to one, they can come to all 3. And obviously the more classes you attend, the more you fully integrate some of this material. But we see it even after the very first workshop, women just feel affirmed in their right to take care of themselves and to speak up, and that they have a right to be safe. This is pivotally important. And some of the information is really new to a lot of women. For example, we talk about affirmative consent, and that's I won't say it's a new concept, but it's a new concept to a lot of people. And
so what exactly is affirmative
consent? So affirmative consent, I'll backtrack a little bit. You know, surely you've heard of no means no. And that was the previous philosophy around sexual assault or whether something constituted sexual assault. Did you say no? You know, and no means no. And so the problem there is that implies that someone has a right to your body until or if you say no.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember pointing out in my book is in the United States, it was only until, I forgot the exact year, but like early 1990s or something, it was very, very late that there was such a thing as marital rape in all states. Mm-hmm. It used to be just presumed that a man had a right to his wife's body and she couldn't say anything about it if they were married. And that's sort of an example of that. It's the very concept that anybody actually, the default wasn't yes all the time.
Right. And so if the concept is only no means no, and someone has a right to your body until or if you say no, well, you can see where that would be problematic in the legal system or in other systems, where if we take the natural adrenaline response to threat, which is often the freeze response, otherwise known as tonic immobility, then a woman might freeze and not be able to say no. And that's a very natural adrenaline, autonomic nervous system response. That's not really consent. It's the frozen response. And previously that was used in the legal system to deny that it was assault. What flips it on its head is this only yes means yes. It means you actually have to get a yes, and it has to be enthusiastic, continuous, and freely given, meaning you can change your mind at any time. That's the continuous part. So I might consent to the first part of whatever's happening physically, but I can change my mind. So it's continuous, and so it's ongoing, has to be freely given. So it means that you can't be coerced or pressured or in other way not really giving your consent, and it has to be enthusiastic. So this concept, I think it's only in about 4 states, and some colleges are adopting this, and I'm hoping it kind of continues to grow. It serves all parties very well because it's about communicating, and it's about clear communicating. And so for women, it means that if they don't say yes, then that's not consent. So for example, if you're, think about situations that we've seen in the media and the news in the past. So if someone's passed out, they didn't say no. So under the old statute, that
right.
that would, well, you didn't say no, but you're passed out and couldn't consent. Now that clearly does not qualify as consent. And I would say it helps men too, because now there's not, again, there's not that guesswork. There's this communication around, do both parties really want to do this? And I think that serves both parties. And I used the word man, you know, as this helps men. I just sort of have to point out that often in our workshops, we talk about, you know, women, again, we're focused on women, perpetrators being men. And I acknowledge that there are women who are perpetrators as well, but 90%+ of perpetrators do tend to be male, even when the victim is male.
Yeah,
well.
I've worked with lesbian couples occasionally, or you know, women who are basically having sex with other women, and they've been assaulted by other women sometimes too. So that also happens as well. So you know, it's a I've noted actually even in some TV shows in the last couple of years, not a lot yet, but some where in when they're starting to show a sex scene, there will be something that is clearly influenced by that idea that they need to be giving each other affirmative consent. And they sort of built it in, you know, not quite seamlessly yet, I think, because I still noticed it. But they've built that into some of the scenes. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon because it also flies in the face of a lot of old romantic notions about spontaneity. And I'm always fascinated about that. You know, the idea that, well, if it isn't spontaneous, you know, some people just bristle at the concept of even planning to have sex. They think that there's something inauthentic about that. And then when you pile on top of that, that they actually have to have a conversation at the moment that establishes affirmative consent. I've talked to some people who are struggling with it because they're feeling like, oh, doesn't that render the whole thing, doesn't that take it away from the sort of spontaneity of intimacy? Have you heard about that? Or
yes,
that,
I've heard people say that, and you know, first of all, I don't think it has to be an extended conversation. You know, it's certainly it can be a question. It can be, are you comfortable with this? Is this okay? And I certainly think that you can make anything. I mean, I think you can make anything sexy. You can. I don't think it has to detract from the experience. I think you could make it enhance the experience.
Yeah, doing dishes can be sexy in the circumstances.
Exactly. So, yes, I've heard that, and I, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad to hear that you've noticed that the media is beginning to make a change, because surely we have seen, we have all seen how the media has portrayed. I guess I like to call it, the media sort of puts forth this idea that typically men should persist even if she resists. That's think about, you know, a lot of these movies that, you know, and I'm sure we all can think of examples where that's the case. And
Gone with the Wind.
And, you know, that would not. That would not fit under affirmative consent right now.
You know, one of this is kind of ironic, I think, but one of the domains that I've heard about, I suppose by saying I've heard about it, that really implies I'm not part of this sort of thing, but I've heard about, I've learned a lot about it from my clients actually over the years. The world of dominant submission, oddly enough, of all places, is one of the places that those of us who are not into that can learn a lot about the notion of affirmative consent. Of all things, it's really surprising because people have to be very open before they get into any of this sort of activity about what they really mean by saying, no, I want you to dominate me. But there's, you know, they'll have things like safe words and stuff like that. They will build into that a very conscious kind of agreement about how to keep it safe so that it really is consent. Even though what they're wanting, and it's been fascinating to me to learn about this over the years, there's some people who what they seem to need in their sex life is to be dominated. And that would imply in the moment, you know, if somebody were to ask in the moment, that would be a complete buzz killer for them. But they still, it still needs to be affirmative consent. And that's, that's why I think it's so ironic that the folks who are into that seem to be much better equipped to handle these sorts of issues because they're so used to actually being open in their communication before they get started about exactly what they want and what's the safeguard.
I never thought of that.
It is. Have you heard about that, Christine?
I have. Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm well versed in that area. However, I have heard that in fact that there are sort of written contracts, you know, that it's very, very clear. And that, you know, that's where that communication, that clarity of expectations and desires and that ongoing communication, it can certainly work. It's a shift for our society to go that route in terms mm-hmm. of this conversation and talking, or not even a conversation, just this communicating around it. But I do hope it's the direction that we go in, because I think it's good for all involved. You know, if you think about, let's just say young men, because we work a lot on college campuses, and you are probably familiar with the rates of sexual assault on college campuses or at epidemic level. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's, you know, 1 in 4, perhaps more. We also know that sexual assault is the least reported crime that there is. So who knows what the actual number is. But often, you know, there's been studies that have shown that, you know, they'll survey college men and they'll list some of the behaviors, you know, sexual behaviors. And there's a subset that will admit to behaviors that qualify as rape, but they don't think it's rape.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. and so that's very alarming. But if this sort of affirmative consent is out there, it makes it very clear to everyone involved, and for both men and women, this is what's acceptable. This is what needs to happen so that you know you're not doing something to hurt someone else and you're not being hurt.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's good for everyone.
There was maybe you've seen this sign. I don't know if it was like in a demonstration or something. I mean, I remember being just horrified to see it. It was somebody was saying, "No means yes, and yes means anal."
Yes, fraternities. I've seen fraternities, hanging on fraternities, and that's a particular. I mean, I think, gosh, I'd have to refresh my mind on the statistic, but fraternities have a much higher rate of sexual assault. As well as sororities have a higher rate of being sexually assaulted, you know, so that's disturbing.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. And we all know there's a lot of alcohol involved mm-hmm. usually. Mm-hmm. So
this might be an opportune moment to turn to a listener question. I think as our listeners know, we often include a question from a listener as part of our podcast. And so we have one. And when you hear this, Christine, you will realize, gee, we picked this one out for you. It really does seem to be right up your alley. So go for it.
Okay, Christine. So Susan writes, I'm a 30-year-old cisgendered heterosexual woman living on my own since college. I have a good job, a good relationship with my family, and good friends. Sounds fine, right? But I can't seem to sustain a romantic relationship, even though I really want one. Every time I meet a guy I'm attracted to, it seems to go well up until we start to get it on physically. And I'm talking about respectful, consensual encounters. Even though I really want to continue, I just shut down. Mm-hmm. And then I find all sorts of excuses to stop seeing him, even though I like him. I suppose I should mention I was date raped in high school. I thought I'd gotten past that. I don't think much about it. What can I do to get over this? Okay, so that's what Susan wants to know.
Well, that's a great question, Susan. You know, what it highlights is the trauma activation. You know, while we may think that we are over something, that, as Bessel van der Kolk talks about, is a renowned psychiatrist working in the field of trauma, the body remembers. Mm. Because we think we're over trauma, it doesn't mean we actually have worked through the neurological, biological basis of the traumatic response. And so what can often happen is that the trauma, it alters the way that memory works. It alters the way we react to certain things that are triggers. And that, you know, the approach we use in our therapeutic impairment self-defense, the approach that's used in other somatic forms of therapy, is to involve the body in that treatment to move through the trauma. My advice to Susan would be to work through this with a therapist who is trauma-informed and can help you move through the somatic, the biological, the physiological response of trauma. And there's a number of different ways to do that, including EMDR. And Bruce, I think you do EMDR. I do EMDR, which is a trauma treatment.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, at the risk of getting a little technical, I was going to ask you if you could differentiate a bit between the EMDR type approach, which I have done, and some of the things that you would do in terms of empowerment self-defense. Because I think, if nothing else, I would imagine that some of the stuff you're talking about in empowerment self-defense involves a lot more of the body and moving a lot more
Absolutely.
Muscles. EMDR, of course, is
not really. And can I just interrupt on behalf of us lay people? Can you explain a little bit what EMDR is and some of the other terms that you use, like somatic experiences and that?
Sure. You know. So okay. Just moving back, you know, somatic treatments involve the body. In terms of the empowerment self-defense or the therapeutic empowerment self-defense, we integrate the mind and the body. What I would say the therapeutic empowerment self-defense has in common with EMDR is both require a sense of safety, comfort with the therapist and the situation that you're in, but they go about moving through the trauma in somewhat different ways. To describe EMDR in a couple of sentences is a little tricky.
I'll start off by translating, by giving the what it stands for. It stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is something of a mouthful itself. And it implies that it involves eye movements. But the funny thing about EMDR is soon after the developer of it, Francine Shapiro, soon after she developed it, she and other researchers figured out there are other modalities besides eye movements that can have very similar effects. But the basic thing that it does, and then I want to hear, Christine, from you, you know, there's some differences when you're talking about some of the other approaches. The basic thing EMDR does, indeed, as you were saying, is it sets up a situation where the panic response is not likely to happen because you're in a safe place, because you have a relationship with a therapist, because you're doing these physical movements either with your eyes or other, sometimes they use sounds that go back and forth between your ears, things that seem to have the effect of interrupting what otherwise would be a panic cycle. So then you're invited to review mentally the awful things that happened to you when your body is relatively relaxed. And that's the circumstance where your brain can then learn it's okay to remember those things. It's not an emergency to remember even something horrible because memories aren't dangerous. What was dangerous is what happened to you. So that's what EMDR does. Uh-huh. And so Christine, yeah, could you kind of take it from there? Like, what do some of the other somatic therapies do?
Well, I can talk about specifically the therapeutic empowerment self-defense. And, you know, the idea behind that is exactly what you said, Bruce, in terms of what EMDR does. But it's sort of one step further because we actually move the body, learning some basic self-defense techniques. Actually, you know, women will end up sort of hitting a focus mitt, but they're doing it under a condition of safety, condition of comfort. The idea being, as Peter Levine, another trauma expert, has said, is that trauma is a thwarted response to a threat to your safety. So you couldn't respond. So, for example, you had that freeze, that natural tonic immobility, that autonomic nervous system response that happens quite commonly, particularly in sexual assault situations. So you weren't able to do what you needed to do or may have wanted to do to protect yourself. And so moving the body through some of those movements in a safe place while we're also working on the cognitive part. We spend a lot of time talking about trying to redirect blame towards the perpetrator, working on self-confidence, but actually moving the body. You'd be amazed at how we teach women how to stand, how to hold themselves with confidence, and then how to move their body through some of these very basic strikes. It's remarkable watching that happen. And sometimes women will do the striking while they're visualizing their perpetrator or what happens, but they don't necessarily have to. Yeah. There's just something about integrating that mind body, moving the body while you're working on becoming more powerful, that I'd like to say it's magical. I know it's not. I know it's neurobiological, but appears magical.
Indeed. And because you're really going right to the source. That's a great description, Peter Levine's description, you know, that it's a thwarting of something that you needed to have done. You know, I remember I did a training once a long time ago with Bessel van der Kolk, actually, and he this was a few years after 9/11. He put up a slide where he showed, you probably remember this horrible scene of people running up Broadway in Lower Manhattan to get away from, you know, the collapsing buildings. And he said, at least at the time, the rate of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, among the people in that sort of scene, they weren't talking about the individuals in the picture, but the rate of PTSD was surprisingly low. And he pointed at the picture and he said, look what they're doing. They're running. Mm-hmm. They're not thwarted. They're terrified, but they're running. They're doing what they needed to do. And of course, the ones that survived it did it successfully. Mm-hmm. So they were not nearly as traumatized as people who are in situations, again, very often like sexual assault, where they're frozen.
And just to sort of put out there, that's a natural neurobiological response, that freeze response, that
Absolutely,
fight,
yeah.
flight, freeze. So there's no blame there, that your body is just doing what your brain and body are just doing what they are geared to do.
But what we and reptiles, I mean, we've been, that's, the who's the one who writes about the front or the different vagal responses.
Stephen Porges.
Thank you, Stephen Porges, yes, writes about that, and the that response of freezing is older in terms of our development. It's basic to all of us. We play dead if we have to.
And there may have been a time where that was adaptive. It just
Oh, of
isn't.
course,
It
yeah.
just isn't in these situations, you know. So it sets up that PTSD, the traumatic response, the activation when something appears to be similar to the traumatic event. So Susan, when in her head, wants to have this intimate experience, but the cues may be similar enough to whatever happened to create the trauma that it sets off that neurobiological response, and then she's activated.
I think that's often even worse. I mean, I don't know how to, it's all horrible, but the, date rape in particular has something in common with sexual abuse from a parent, because it's in a situation where you think you're with someone you can trust. And so that in particular is damaging in terms of an actually loving relationship. That's going to seem, it's going to have some parallels with something like, well, I'm with somebody I like. It's not like somebody jumped out of the bushes and attacked, which again is horrible. I'm not saying that isn't horrible, but there's something particular about date rape, I think, that can have that effect on relationships in the future.
Well, it's a betrayal of trust, you know.
Yeah.
So you thought you were safe, but you're really not. And so if you weren't safe in that situation, how do you know when you're safe in other situations that are somewhat similar? And again, on a neurobiological level, you may not even be thinking that, but your brain and your body remember. And the other thing
Exactly.
I would point out, Bruce, that's a good point. And part of the problem is that something like 85% of sexual assaults are with someone you know,
Yeah.
someone familiar. And so you can see how this would be a common issue that would affect couples. That trauma activation may occur at a time when you're really trying to connect with your partner, but your body remembers and doesn't feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So, Christine, I have a question for you. How do people find out about you? I mean, are they referred by doctors, by police officers? How would somebody find out about your safety
Well,
team?
we have a website, thesafetyteam.org. It would be a great way to find out about our upcoming community classes. We also have this therapeutic impairment self-defense class, and that works program. I shouldn't even say they're classes. They're much smaller groups that it's a bit different. And the way I would describe the community classes is they're focused on prevention. Even though we know a good portion of the participants are survivors, we focus on prevention. It's a community class. We don't have the same opportunity to have in-depth discussion. So I think of it as prevention with a side of healing, because that does happen. And the therapeutic impairment self-defense program is just the opposite. I think of it healing with a side of prevention. So they're similar, but they're a bit different. And the therapeutic impairment self-defense program is sponsored by the Vermont Center for Crime Victim Services, and it's free to participants. You receive up to three individual sessions, and then we work in a small group, no more than four participants with two instructors. And it's been phenomenally powerful to watch the healing, and it really is remarkable to watch what happens in these sessions. Sometimes it's the first time that women have been in a group where they know, a small group, where they know the other participants have experienced somewhat of a similar event that they have. Some of these women have never shared it with anyone before. And so the connection amongst women, either in these small groups or in these large groups, is part of what makes it so powerful. It's really something to watch.
And can they find that information at the same website?
Yes, it's at the same website. They can also email me at Christine, and that's with a CH, Christine at thesafetyteam.org. And I'm happy to share information with them.
That's great. And actually, I was going to ask you, because you're talking about a program, of course, based in Vermont. Do you know of similar programs in other states? Or, and we have listeners all over the world, actually. So do you know of other
Where
programs in other
there are
places?
other empowerment self-defense programs, and that's what people would want to search for, an empowerment self-defense program, because they are different than your traditional self-defense program that does not call itself an empowerment self-defense program. But in terms of the therapeutic empowerment self-defense, this is an innovative program that we are working with two national researchers, one from Brown University and another from Towson University. We've submitted a couple of grants to analyze the program, but it's a brand new program. While we know anecdotally that the community workshops, not just the ones we do, but that others offer, assist with healing, it hasn't been studied, and it certainly hasn't been done in the way that we're offering it, in terms of the individual small group with a different, specifically attuned curriculum to survivors. So that is not widely available, but empowerment self-defense programs may be in the area where people live.
And so you're saying there's a research component to this grant that you're working
on? Well, the one we're doing with the Vermont Center for Crime Victims is purely treatment. It is just free treatment.
Oh, okay.
And we've applied for a large grant, I think it's through the Department of Justice, to work with Norwich University, which is a local college, and their community, and these two other researchers from different universities to analyze the program, to offer it over in Norwich. I guess it's Washington County Mental Health or Washington County, Vermont, to analyze the program.
Parenthetically, where I did my internship, incidentally, at Norwich University.
So there are two different things. One is treatment, and we're offering that, and we've offered that since, it's been about a year. And the other is to more carefully research it and develop it so that we can share it more widely.
So, Christine, is there a takeaway you want people to get from your work and the safety team's mission?
Bruce, there are many, but I'll try to limit it to just three that are relevant to this discussion. I would say the first, we talked at length about affirmative consent, only yes means yes. And I can't emphasize enough how much I think that improves communication, it prevents misunderstandings or even worse between partners. You can see how it would be helpful for all involved to clearly know what your partner wants or doesn't want. It takes that guesswork out of that whole process. So that's the first thing. The second is about, we talked a lot about empowerment, and the safety team, our mission is about empowering women. And a point I just want to make is that empowered women, empowered people, simply means that women, people are more comfortable with themselves, with their voice, their bodies, and asserting their boundaries. This too can have a ripple effect in a positive way in relationships, as it reinforces that clear communication. We talked about trauma recovery, and the Therapeutic Empowerment Self-Defense Program is specifically focused on trauma recovery. And a point related to that is that this recovery, this healing, helps not only the survivor, but also the other people in her life. And if your partner is a survivor of trauma, what I would say to you is, in order to be a good support, to help your loved one heal, you can do that by listening, by believing them, by supporting them, and by respecting them, and by being a safe person for them to be with and to share with.
Yeah, indeed. That's actually something I do go into in my book, actually, because I'm talking about couple relationships, and that very phenomenon, of course, is very common in couples.
You know, I like to think that when in doubt, a great question to ask, if you don't know what to say, a great question to ask is, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
How can I help? What do you need? How can I help? I'm here. How can I help? And then the last point I would like to talk about is just broadening gender norms. And what I mean by that is just expanding our ideas and our expectations about what is okay or acceptable behavior for men and women. If we expand what is expected or acceptable for men and women, it allows us all to have a much wider range of healthy emotions and behaviors, rather than having a really prescribed limited set of behaviors or expectations for how we should be. I think as a society, we're moving in that direction. I sure hope so. And I also hope that as a society, we're moving in the direction of more safety and respect and empowerment for all of us. And I think we are seeing that happen.
And that sounds like a great thing to aspire to for all of us, and a great note to end our interview on as well. So thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much, Bruce and Judy. I really appreciate you having me on.
Okay, Christine, thank you so much. So that was a wonderful interview with Christine de Blasio, and stay tuned because in the next few weeks we've got a bunch more interviews coming up.
And we have found some really fascinating folks out there, and indeed we are looking for any other suggestions for fascinating folks for us to interview on this program, and that could include you yourself. So if indeed you'd like to suggest yourself, or anyone else for that matter, go to brucechalmer.com. You will see there is a podcast tab. You can actually listen to the podcast from that same tab as well. And there is a link on there if you want to sign up for a time for us to interview you. And you can also, through that same website, just send me email. It would go to bruce@brucechalmer.com, or there's a form on that site. You can send me email. And let us know if there's some folks you'd like us to interview. So, as I mentioned earlier, this whole podcast is based on my book, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. It's available wherever books are sold. And if you like our podcast and you'd like more people to find out about it, of course, tell your friends, spread the word, and comment and rate and like and share our posts on social media, because that's how people find out about these things these days. Mm-hmm. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.